唱歌，我就把
that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Oh, Hotep, Alafia, and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here on Tuesday evenings at 8 p.m. from 8 to 10. I am your host, William Rogers. It is an honor and a pleasure to be with you here as we talk about some of the crucial and vital issues impacting the black world. So we are here in a wonderful dynamic conversation that we're going to be having in just a few minutes on Follow Him, Follow Marcus Garvey. We're going to talk a little bit about Marcus Garvey. It's celebrating his birthday in a week or so, and a couple of events that have led up to his birthday that we want to sort of highlight and discuss and talk about the relevancy of some of those kinds of things. But we are so appreciative that you are here with us each Tuesday. As I said, we also air on Saturdays from 4 to 6 p.m. on the Block Talk radio system. On this system, we are here for timeforanawakening.com and the Black Talk Radio Network platform. And so we are real happy to be here. We are produced by the Sankofa Historical Society, and the program is sponsored here on timeforanawakening.com by Motherland Media Network. And so we are also very, very appreciative of them and their contribution that they've made to making sure that we can dialogue on very critical issues facing our community. Brother Oshie Madelabu is the managing person behind the Black Talk, behind Motherland Media, and he also has a program that airs on this network as well. So again, welcome, and we are going to launch right into our discussion very shortly. But as always, I always like to honor our ancestors. That is a part of our program ritual here. And it's like the great Fannie Lou Hamer said, you always must praise the bridges that brought us over. As well as the old African proverb that says, when you honor your ancestors, your soul breathes. When you honor your ancestors, your soul breathes. So very clearly, we do not ever want to not be able to do that. So today, I'm going to talk very briefly about a brother that sort of is relevant to some of our discussion and what we're going to be talking about today. He's not known by many people, so this will be an excellent opportunity for some to introduce him and for others just to sort of reinforce, you know, who he is. His name is Leonard Howell. Leonard Howell, H-O-W-E-L-L. Leonard Percival Howard. He was born in June 16, 1898, and he transitioned February 25, 1981. He is also known as the Gong, he was often called, and he was a Jamaican religious figure. According to his biographer, Helene Lee, Howard was born into an Anglican family. He was one of the first preachers of the Rastafari movement, along with people such as Joseph Hibbert, Archibald Dunkley, and Robert Hines. And he is known by many as the first Rasta, the first Rasta. He was born in Maycraw River, Jamaica. Howell left the country as a youth, traveling to many places, including Panama and New York. And he returned to Jamaica in 1932. He began preaching in 1933 about what he considered the symbolic, potent idea for the African diaspora. And that was to recount the crowning of Rastafari Mekonnen, better known as Emperor Haile Selassie I of Ethiopia. His preaching asserted that Haile Selassie was the Messiah who had returned to earth. And he published a book called The Promised Key. The Promised Key. And you can purchase that book in some places. But he did publish a book promoting the idea of Haile Selassie being the Messiah. Although this resulted in his being arrested and tried for sedition, and he was imprisoned for 2 years. The Rastafari movement grew because of this conflict. And over the following years, Howell came into conflict with all establishment orders and authorities in Jamaica. The planters there were against him. The trade unions were against him. Established churches, police, and the colonial authorities were opposed to Howell's idea. Howell was seen as a threat, and it was largely due to the anti-colonial message of the Rastafari movement, which he was perpetrating along with sermons promoting the idea of a positive black racial identity. And anytime you do that, you always come up against the authority, the colonial authority. Local ruling elites were uneasy with Howell's popular call for black people to take a stand. Colonial authorities hoped to quell Howard's growing movement early so as to snuff out people to overcome white oppression, and his movement expanded to become an international concern given his strong messages of black liberation and pan-Africanism. And these ideas resonated with Africans all across the globe. He formed a town, some called it a commune, and it was called Pinnacle, and it was in the St. Catherine Parish of Jamaica, and that became famous as a place for the Rastafari. This movement prospered, and today the Rastafari faith exists worldwide. And unlike many Rastas, Howell never wore dreadlocks. He interacted with the people of the likes of George Padmore, Marcus Garvey, and others. And he was a viable force, an ideological force in Jamaica behind the whole Rastafari Haile Selassie movement. It was Howell that was responsible for, in many cases, getting people to participate in sending support over to Ethiopia to fight the Italians during the Nazi. He was behind a lot of the ideas of that. So he was a very valuable figure. He ties well into what we are going to talk about today as we discuss a little bit about the great Marcus Garvey. And Leonard Howell died on February 1981 in Kingston, Jamaica. I would suggest, however, that any of you have an interest in this brother, that you do take a look, and by all means look at his book, The Promised Key. Again, Leonard Howell. Leonard Percival Howell. H-O-W-E-L-L. Okay, thank you, brothers and sisters, for that. That was what our ancestral profile for today. One of the things that has spawned our idea for our discussion today was that on this past weekend, there were 800 African-American, Latino, and Native American men who led a peaceful march through the downtown area of Memphis, Tennessee. It was highlighted on Facebook. It was highlighted in the local Memphis press, as well as some independent news stations as well. Didn't a lot of the stations cover it, obviously. I'm sure you know that. These were religious men. They were who were concerned about the level of violence, poverty, and the lack of care in their community. This type of action is not new, however, among community-minded men, and particularly is not new in the Memphis area. You have seen things like this with Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, Malcolm X, organized men to move forward, make a statement when it was necessary. Martin Luther King, he lost his life in Memphis. Based on a march that men did called Men, I Am a Man, and men and about the hundreds marched down the street in Memphis protesting the mistreatment of the sanitation workers there. And eventually, as I said, we know that King lost his life that day in support of that movement. And others, there are others who have taken to the streets in a show of solidarity when injustice is the order of the day. And so on August 17th, 2018, the African world is going to celebrate the 131st birthday of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. And so we thought today here at the Black Reality Think Tank that we would take a look at Garvey's principles about manhood and some of the work that needs to be done and how it is that you're going to do it. A lot of our liberation has a lot of questions. You have a lot of opinions of things that when I did post the announcement of our program on today, I got a lot of feedback from folks. Folks said stuff like, I had one brother that wrote, he said, this is more soft shit. Y'all niggas are scared to live. And some of the other things that they said about the fact that men galvanize themselves together. And I did respond to those. I understand that it does appear that it is soft, but you have to create a sense of pride. Marcus Garvey said, you liberate the minds of men, and ultimately, you will liberate the bodies of men. And so what we have to do sometimes in our world today and where we are, and because of mental slavery, because of oppression, and because of internalized oppression, we've got to re-wake the soul and re-wake the spirit of our people and our community. And we have to let them know that they can stand up and fight. And I think that's what Garvey was doing. And surely we want to talk about that today. We want to look at some of his principles based on his writings and just exactly what he was saying, and even to the point of how we might be able to implement that into the ways today. This is a two-part series, and so today we're going to just kind of highlight the philosophical framework and ideas of the Garvey Movement. And then on next Tuesday, same time, 8 p.m., Eastern Time here on the block on the timeforanawakening.com system. We are going to bring on a group called Africans on the Move. Africans on the Move. It was an organization started by a very dear and close friend and colleague. And the members of the Africans on the Move are also members of the Pan-African Revolutionary Socialist Party. And they have dedicated their lives to living, teaching, and following the philosophy of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. And so our conversation was also going to highlight, as we honor the life and legacy of Dr. Ahmed Mbalia, who transitioned to the ancestor realm in 2017. Dr. Mbalia was one of the founders and the leaders of Africans on the Move. They're still in existence. His lovely, wonderful wife, Dr. Doretha Mbalia, who are all professors in the department, were professors in the Department of Africology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, were very vital in the community. Every year, during my whole span of time in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, they held a Garvey Day around August the 10th, the 11th, somewhere in there, and they do have one coming up, and they celebrated the life of Marcus Garvey. Very clearly, they published a newspaper called the Nkrumah. And we're going to talk about all that. I won't talk about it now, but I just wanted to mention why this is vital. So what we're going to do is show you an example of organizations and people using Garvey's philosophy and logic and applying that and implementing it in the community. And I know there are people that say, well, what is that going to do? You know, well, you can say that about anything, you know, I appreciate those brothers who and sisters who are thinking like that, but I think you have to be a little bit more open. That it takes time to change a revolution. There is no coincidence why countries like the Soviet Union, Russia, North Korea will have parades and march their machinery, their weaponry, and their soldiers down the street and show that they have pride, that there is unity. That they're willing to stand up for their cause. It's even been so impressive that I understand that this president decided that he wants to let America do that, that they want to have a parade and march their soldiers down the street and show off their weaponry. Well, some of that is, you know, window dressing stuff, but however, it's important. And window dressing, sometimes it does say to others in there that, you know, this is what we need to do. This is where we need to be. Marcus Garvey did it quite often. Every Saturday afternoon in Harlem, he held a parade and he dressed up in uniform, military style, and they rolled down the streets of 125th Street on around the Lenox Avenue. That was a little bit before my time. I didn't get to see that during my years in New York, obviously, because that was way ahead of my time. But anyway, nevertheless, it was very effective. And over the years in my reading and studying of Garvey, it was very effective. Of course, there were people that criticized it, but there were also people who stood on the sidelines who didn't understand a lot of that, were galvanized to stand up and get involved. He would march the Black Cross nurses down the street, and a lot of his men would be done that way. Again, galvanizing strength and pride. The Nation of Islam does that quite often. You know, they have their military drills and marching, and those young people are coordinated and organized, and it's impressive. Fraternities, sororities do it. So there is a argument that this can be used to galvanize people. Now, it's not going to get us out of oppression. It's not going to get you to the next level and some of the other things that we're going to need to do as people to liberate ourselves. But it is preparing men and women for action. And that's what I think this march. So that march on Saturday was inspirational for me. I thought maybe it would be good to use that as we talk about the Garvey idea and philosophy. I thought about it as I was watching it. I said to myself, I wonder what Jeff Sessoms is saying now. What is he doing? What is he preparing? Because obviously there's something that obviously it drew their attention to. And I noticed that in the video you didn't see police officers or anything like that. So I can just imagine what that might have been like. But so anyway, today we're going to talk about Garvey. We don't necessarily have a special guest. I've got several brothers and sisters that are online now that I know that wish to say some things and talk about the whole Garvey point of idea and movement. Marcus Garvey, as you know, is often credited with Back to Africa, but that's, I think, just a little bit, that's just not enough of what he and who he really was. So in a sense, there's a lot more to him, and there's a lot more that I think we need to look at in reference to that. He wrote his own philosophy system. His wife, Amy Garvey, did help pull together some of his thoughts and ideas about politics and what needs to happen. And his famous quote that I love so much that we use to introduce today's program is, "Up, you mighty race. Up, you mighty race. You can achieve what you will." And so I think that that is a strong message, motto, for moving the ideas. And then the question becomes, how do we put it together? How do we get people to bind this? How do we teach a community of folks about using the garbage skills and using the ideas? And as one brother said to me on his reply to our program, he said a lot of that can't be discussed on social media. And he's right, and I can't, and I'm not attempting to do that today. I just want to get an opinion from our brothers and sisters that are listening. Just what do we do? There are some questions that are preliminary to actually putting a plan in work for liberation. I think that it is one. There is a blueprint. There are blueprints out there that we can look at some things that we can do and how to do it. Very clearly, any program for change in the African community is going to have to include a very progressive and aggressive plan of economics. There is going to have to be something that is said and done that will improve the economic status of African people. You can't take people into liberating change if they are hungry, or if they are homeless, or if they are struggling and suffering, if their children are not eating and not being fed properly. We have to do that. We have to create an independent system, not a dependent system, because basically, historically, we know that it has been dependent systems. AFDC, W-2, and all those catastrophic programs have been used as a way of attempting to help African people, which we know that it did not. If anything, it made it worse. And so we can't look upon anybody else outside of our own community to do that but ourselves. So any plan, any discussion, any agenda would have to include economics first as a part of how to do that. But right now we want to, and Garvey knew that. He knew that in his work as well. And so one of the things that I think he did, and as you look at his writings and his works, it's actually it's clearly categorized of what he was saying. You know, first you had to create a pride in yourself. And never mind, and just, I said, you got to create a self. You got to feel that you are somebody and that you can do so. So a lot of that we have to do. We have to do that with our children. We can't pass that on to the educational system because they're not going to do that. Parents are struggling to provide food, clothing, shelter. Somebody has to get in and work with the pride of our children. So that's kind of how we want to begin our conversation tonight. Our program, as you know, is a call-in format. For those of you who are listening via the internet, you can call us at area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, area code 215-490-9832. And at any point you want to ask a question or discuss, by all means, do so. So if you can, again, 215-490-9832, that's our call-in number here at the Black Reality Think Tank. Okay, I'm going to open up the mic of one of our guests that I know that is here, and I'm going to give him an opportunity to join in with me on this conversation and just to say, but I want to start off first with some information, some basic information that has been honed from Garvey's writings that I would like to talk about and to sort of get some understanding of how to work with. So first of all, let me say good afternoon to my brother out of Philadelphia. I'll bring you on first. Good afternoon, my brother. How are you today?
Yes, Dr. Rogers, thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Good.
And I want to say I'm learning a lot from the listening audience. Just as I'm talking, they hear me. And just as they're talking, I hear them. But I'm going to say this, Dr. Rogers. I happen to be fortunate this weekend because it's the first time I had participated in this Marcus Garvey Independent Festival that they have every year.
Right.
And they marked from 52nd and Market, for those who are familiar with West Philadelphia, to 52nd and Pine.
Who organized that march? Who's the organization that organizes that?
Now, sir, Elliot knows better of that organization because he usually has them on his air every time the day before they come. He announces a week before they come.
Okay.
But I will find out because if they're that close to giving this thing in August, I'm going to ask Elliot to get in contact with them. And we should say to him, let's have it on Marcus Garvey's birthday.
Okay.
If Marcus Garvey's birthday happened to fall on a Saturday, let's have it on that day. If it happened to fall on a Sunday, let's have it on a day. Or maybe a Friday. Depends on how we could compromise with that date.
Yeah, it's the 17th of August. That's when it is.
Dr. Rogers, it was a phenomenal feat. I'm going to say this, that in that march, you got a chance to see what Black pride was like in Philadelphia. I could imagine what it was like in the 20s. Give you an example. In some of the writings of Adam Clayton Powell, he says as a young man, he would watch the parade of Garvey in New York. And he said, Garvey was a very misunderstood person.
Yes.
He said people did not understand what Garvey was when it came. They understood the pride part, but his mission and his goal. He has a book called A Portrait of a Marching Soldier. Maybe that soldier part may be incorrect. But I'll tell you something, Dr. Rogers, that from reading Garvey's writings, there is I'm familiar with race first, but there's a book that I'm going to refer people to. It's by Colin Grant. It's called The Negro with a Hat. And who referred to him at was Dr. W.E. Du Bois.
Repeat the title again.
Repeat
the title again, brother. Repeat the title and the name of the book again.
Sure. The book is called, the author of the book is called, his name is Colin, C-O-L-I-N Grant, G-R-A-N-T.
Okay.
And the book, the name of the title of the book is The Negro with a Hat. And he refers to that. That's what Du Bois refers to him as that. It's like he was an empty-headed person. Garvey was far from empty-headed. It's called The Rise and Fall of Marcus Garvey. And when you get into it, it says a lot about Garvey's work, his mission, his praying press, his organization skills. And I'm going to say this to you, sir. When you talk about what this president called 45 wants to do with the military parade, I read some writings where Mussolini loved Marcus Garvey so much that when he came out with his, I think he had the black shirts, they marched on Rome, Hitler marched on Munich, that he loved the dressing of Marcus Garvey. He wanted to be as flamboyant as Marcus Garvey.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, put that pitch in.
Okay. All right. Well, okay, let's do this. There are a couple of, I think, headline titles that we can give to the vision of Marcus Garvey. And we can kind of, we're not going to be able to cover all of it, but we can just kind of talk a little bit about some of the key points in those headline areas. Number one is that I think his first job was to raise the consciousness and the pride of our people. He often said that our people are asleep. We say that all the time, even now. They still sleep. And one of his quotes is, slumber that makes us believe that everything is okay and that the world is fair. There are a lot of black folk out here that believe that everything is okay and that we're going to be all right and that we are doing that. That's one of the first problems. And Garvey saw that when he came to New York in the 1920s. He saw that as well. And then he said, there's a lack of awareness that is afflicting a lot of us. We are not aware of the trouble around us. Most animals in the animal kingdom have built within them some type of sensory device that can tell them when danger is upon them. And they can sense that. It's either through smell, touch. They can hear things. Like I remember watching one of those animal channels where the elephants, for instance, can hear and feel with their trunks when something is happening, when somebody is coming upon them. So, but somehow or the other, we have not been able, we had it, but we lost it. We've lost somehow that ability, that sensory device that comes with nature to talk about impending danger. The people in the church in Charleston, South Carolina, did not know that Dylann Roof was a problem. They did not sense that danger. And as a result of that, he was able to wreak havoc. So Garvey says that lack of awareness is to that. You want to respond to those three ideas, Brother Timothy? Brother Timothy, you there? Okay, all right, so those ideas very clearly are major in terms of making yourself aware and coming back to doing something. We have to find some way to work with that and to gain our children and to wake up those senses. Then there's another point that Garvey said, is that he says that the lack of spirituality, and he said he's not referring to the religion, and going to church, but just being spiritual. And I think a part of that awareness and ability to alert yourself to danger is tied into that. We have an African traditional religious system called Ifa, and that can teach you and teach us how to understand those spiritual forces of nature and how they can help you and empower you and lead you. There are many examples of how that works. Study the Haitian Revolution. There is some interesting thoughts that come out of a careful, in-depth study of that situation. But we do have a traditional religious system. Obviously, in the process of the transatlantic slave trade, we lost some of that. And when you got here to the shores of America, that was transferred over to other ideologies. As I've said before here on the Black Reality Think, there are a couple of things that happen, first of all, to captive people. When people are captured, there are mainly three things that the enemy will do. They will take your tongue, obviously, to prevent you from being able to communicate successfully. They will take your God, which is your spiritual system, and they will take that in a way to keep you from being able to call upon those higher powers. We've seen that in history, throughout history. And then the other is that they change your bloodline. They'll go in and crossbreed you with their blood and take away your natural blood so that then you are now crossbred, which in a sense sometimes creates mass confusion, as we see in our world sometimes with the light skin, dark skin issues that we encounter and things like that. So, but our traditional African religions can ground us back to some of those original ideas. Some of the stuff you can't change. You can't change that light skin, dark skin thing anymore. That's in there. That's a permanent brand that has been done. But there are ways that we can get into the spirit of people and get into the souls of folk and change that and sort of drive out some of that internalized oppressive behavior that we see we're doing all the time. And then the fifth one is the lack of political awareness and keening up with global issues as they impact upon us as the global African family. We have a problem understanding. See, politics is nothing more than that system of governing the way your life is run and the way you move forward in the acquisition of food, clothing, and shelter. And we've lost the keenness to understand how that works. We think that the Democratic and the Republican parties will help us and that they can carry us on to success. And we see the madness now that is doing that. And that's one thing, one of the value of this administration, it is that it is showing the folly of politics. It is showing the weakness of that. And I hope our people are seeing that and understanding that politics are never, the Republican Democratic system is never going to liberate African people, never. We have to understand the global context of how it all works. We are global people, and there are things that we can obviously do in that light. I was asking you, I had called on you, Brother Timothy, to ask you, what did you, what were your thoughts about, for instance, those first five? Let me go over them again. The first five is that we are asleep. These come right from the writings of Marcus Garvey. He says that we are asleep people, and we got to be awake. He said we lack awareness. That means we don't have the ability to sense out danger. We can't sometimes feel when the enemy is around us, and as a result, we get attacked. We lack consciousness that is affecting our people. We think that the sister down the street, just because she's got an afro, or that brother over there is light skin or dark skin or whatever, we think that's a problem. That's differences, and we create systems of differences. Lack spirituality. And I'm not talking, as I said, he's not talking about going to church or religion. He's talking about the ability to understand the creative energy and yourself. We've lost that connection of what that really means. And then number five is that political awareness piece that I was just talking about. What are your thoughts on those five? And then I've got another brother I want to call on and ask him as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, I'm happy you said something to me about that, sir, because there's been rumors, sir, and I've been searching for years as a brother who's studied nationalism and all type of cultural nationalism and even in different religions and countries about black people around the planet, that there was a rumor that Elijah Muhammad might have been in Marcus Garvey's movement. Now, I've looked through the years at pictures, try to find some writing, and they say he was always influenced by Noble Drew Ali. If you look at Marcus Garvey's movement, and you looked at some of the similarities with Elijah Muhammad, you would say that all these five things were incorporated in the nation. And if you talk to some Garveyites, our philosophy is so close connected. But the other thing, the difference between, I noticed about Elijah Muhammad's new movement and Marcus Garvey is the movement talk about a nation within a nation, where Marcus Garvey was more global in his positions. But I don't think that Elijah Muhammad was ignoring, because remember, FOI uniforms, believe it or not, he had a connection with the people in Japan. Also, Fish, headed and gutted, Whiting, in the Blue Sea Wars of Peru, and he connected with the folks in Peru. And also, he was a very good friend of Shukrano. And also, Muammar Gaddafi helped to build the Mas Mariam in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But he was connected globally. But when his student Malcolm X, to me, was an extension of what Elijah Muhammad was giving him.
Let me ask you a question.
He was influenced by Marcus Garvey.
Brother Timothy, let me ask you a question. Yeah. How does that help us understand the Garvey principles and ideology that we need to use? If we come to the conclusion that Elijah Muhammad was a part of the Garvey movement and Noble Drew Ali, Chris Cross, how does that help us now understand then what we need to do that? And I'm not saying it doesn't. I'm just asking you from your perspective, how does it help us move forward? How do we use that?
My perspective, buying black, Marcus Garvey's plan, the economic piece. Elijah Muhammad had schools, businesses, and hospitals. That was the main objective. It was economic machine. It all goes back to Booker T. Washington. See, that Booker T. Washington, Marcus Garvey machine, Elijah Muhammad machine is all one thing. The other thing is Marcus Garvey was the first, but I believe, to paint the pictures of Jesus black. Elijah Muhammad made us think black. He broke the psychology of the white man. I believe that we were blessed. We've had various people coming our ranks in America. And Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, Du Bois, and Booker T. Washington were like prophets to us in America, if we understand it like that.
Okay.
And they were our guys look like us. Like in Asia, Japan, China, their guys look like them. They made our guys look like us, and we were successful with that ingredient.
Okay, all right. Now, okay, so then basically what you're saying is that this is an example of unification that we could look at, that they were willing to come together and work as a group instead of what we do sometimes now is fight because you are part of this group. I ain't going to work with them Muslims. They ain't Christian. They don't believe in Jesus. Or I'm not going to work with this group because they doing this and they doing that. Like I got when I put the announcement on Facebook, there were people that said that this was not that march in Memphis was bullshit. And excuse my expression, but that's what they said.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm gonna give you a perfect example of what Howard Cruz was saying in his book. Okay, the crisis of the Negro intellectual. What Martin Luther King and Malcolm X did come together, that was the Booker T. Washington, Du Bois, Elijah Muhammad machine, and Noble Drew Ali all together. Because that was the example of the closest thing of the Negro crisis. Because the socialists are going to hook up with the nationalists. But the thing is that we all use socialism and nationalism in our own way, but we need to be black with it. That was the perfect example. Those two together. Check it out.
Okay. All right.
That's just my position now.
Okay, and that's good.
And I like to listen to other people because I'm learning from other people.
That's the blockage. That's some of the blockage for us being able to work and come up with a solution. Because my question is, how do we get people to the table to talk about the challenges that we are faced, talk about the, what we might perceive as being the right way, the wrong way. What are some of the the historical ideologies that we can bring to that table. That's why I call this the Black
right now,
Reality
Dr.
Think
Rogers,
Tank.
A perfect example right now is the white supremacist that's in the White House. His example of white nationalism. He's hooked up with Russia. He's hooked up with Russians. He's trying to make Russians hook up with Americans because they know their time is up. This is our example now for us to get under our umbrellas as Christians, Muslims, Jehovah's Witness. As long as you black and got pride, we need to get together with the golden objective of schools, hospitals, businesses, building, economic, and land.
So
remember, Marcus Garvey said was land.
That's a great idea. A very utopian concept. The question is, what are the steps to begin that? How do we begin that? How do we do
that? Well, I think some of it, Dr. Rogers, the pressure we under now was bringing us so. It's part of it. I hate to say it. We always work on being kicked in our butts. And we come together for a little while, whether it's the Million Man March, the Woman's March, the Deacons of the Old School Defense want to come together. A crisis always brings us together. But that was the greatness of a Du Bois and more so of the movement of a Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad. Those people had the ingredient, Father Divine,
right.
Black Lives of Metropolis. How did they do it? I'm so interested in what we talk about because I want to be the crazy glue to help it get together. And I just don't want to become in a crisis, Dr. Rogers. That's why I'm here too.
That's what I'm saying.
I want to know what it is too. I'm listening.
We've got to expose that. We've got to ask ourselves, how do we do that? What is the plan of action? What is the steps? And I'm not saying overnight. We can't do it on this program today, but we can kind of look at the steps that we can take. Let me go over here to one of our callers, Brother Griffin. Any thoughts?
I'm not sure I want to wade into it. The only thing I'll say is I did go to a meeting Saturday with a delegation from Zambia.
Okay.
I got to talk for about 45 minutes with the king of the Northwest province. He went through, it was a 3-hour dinner, and he went through and explained to me that they were trying to do some work actually with a local, city next door to me, Newport News.
All right.
It was done through the tourism division. It was a brother by the name of Eric Shepherd. He and his wife Lisa were originally out of Baltimore, but they came down here to Newport News, Virginia, because they worked for about 14 years to get this stuff done. He went on and explained to me that he'd been to Gambia, Zaire, Nigeria, and finally Zambia was the first ones that wanted to grant him over 1,000 acres of land to make a homecoming plot for African people here in the U.S. to do business with them on the continent. So I'm trying to learn from what I've been exposed to from Brother Booker.
Okay.
But I have a little bit different attitude about the continent, because for the last 2 years when listening to Pan-Africans, I started trying to find out what's going on on that continent. And to show you, I try to be diplomatic, but when I was talking to the tourism minister and the minister in charge of basically their engineering and public services, I can't pronounce their name, so I'm not going to chop it up. But I did give them links to this program and to Brother Elliot's program.
Right.
And I also got a chance to talk to the female ambassador that's here in D.C., and she promised me that she would communicate with me through emails and stuff so I can educate myself on it. But I made it plain to them, here's my problem.
Okay.
He said that they're working on this thing. They're trying to get this homecoming for the 400th year of slaves coming to Jamestown. The whole thing is going to be centered around a location I live in, which is Yorktown, Virginia. They're going to start it here in the Colonial Williamsburg area, Newport News, Williamsburg. They call it the Colonial Triangle. They're going to go to Jamestown, and then they're actually going to take a congregation to the groundbreaking in Zambia. But I asked the younger gentleman, 40 years old, I said, I do a lot of work on private prisons, and I know that you all have a contract with the GEO group running your prisons in Zambia. I said, now, what I'm seeing is you're setting up the very same system that we're trying to fight here in America, a system that's based on the exception clause in the 13th Amendment that allows people to be put into slavery and bondage if they're duly convicted. Doesn't matter whether they're justly convicted or not. So I don't understand how you're telling me you're advancing your country if all you're doing is duplicating what's being done here on this continent.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that I'm all aboard on this idea that somehow relationships with Africa is going to save us. I do believe that we as a people have to learn to disagree, but work together on the important stuff. And, you know, because I don't hold any animosity against any religion or any of that. But I do believe that until we start working as a people and understand how this country that we're born into works. For instance, anybody that tells me that they don't believe that we should fight for black politics is really telling me we can't have a discussion. You can't do anything in this country. You can't buy a loaf of bread. You can't buy clothes. You can't buy gas. You cannot do anything without participating in a tax system that takes your money, takes it to a government entity, and tell me that you don't want to fight for your fair share of government revenue. Okay. There is not, for instance, people talk about Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett, people don't even understand what that man owns. He owns AIG, who is one of the largest people to get bailed out from TARP. Right. AIG. Right. Why did they get bailed out? They got bailed out because they were skirting the law. Rather, they were actually writing derivatives. Derivatives are nothing but a form of insurance, but is not called insurance because if they labeled it insurance, it would be regulated. Basically, what they were doing is writing contracts for backstops on contracts and breaking them up. And what they were doing, what happened when the housing bubble burst, they did not have enough equity or assets to pay off those contracts. So what happened? Over $1 trillion was paid to AIG. Now, that was just a small branch of AIG that was, and that's owned by Warren Buffett. So if a multi-billionaire is using government, how can you tell me you expect to dig us out of a hole, but you don't want your fair share of your taxes to put into paying, buttressing your businesses, making sure that your communities are up to par, making low interest loans to people who have owned homes for 4 or 5 decades. When you tell me you're here in America and you say we don't need government, I say you have a sheepskin, but you do not have an education. Mm-hmm. There is nothing. Railroads were built on government. Infrastructure was built on government. There's not a single corporation in America that does not ask for its fair share of government. I'm going to close with this. I heard a sister on Brother Elliot's show Sunday talk about the city of Baltimore wanting to sell them a closed school for $2 million. And I heard her say a lot of aspirational stuff, and it's great. But I got a background in doing HUD projects and doing other military contracts. The first thing that came to my mind is when she gave some of the information. Mm-hmm. School's been closed for a long time. It's a 40-50-year-old building. And she used the phrase, that, well, they're trying to dissuade us. I don't want to put words in the mouth, so I'm going to paraphrase. They're trying to dissuade us because they're telling us about asbestos or whatever. Actually, if they, part of the reason the building is probably closed is because that city didn't want to put the money into asbestos abatement or remediation with its several terms they use for it. Mm-hmm. And here's my point. Once it's closed that long and it's sitting on the books in Baltimore, I don't understand why some of the black politicians didn't tell her. If the asking price is $2 million and you're trying to buy it and put it back on the tax rolls, there's plenty of federal and state plans that can basically wipe out the remediation costs take it off the cost of the building and actually give you low interest loans to make sure that you have a certified company remove it. How come the black elected officials aren't trying to help you get that property? Sure, it can have a $2 million price tag, but you might have to only pay $250,000 to get it because it's taking a dead piece of property off the dead rolls and putting it back on the tax base. So I don't understand why we got so many black officials that want to hold a position, but they don't want to educate themselves on the power of what they can do in that position. That's what I'm more concerned with. We can't help Africa until we get our stuff together here. And I'm going to stop there.
Okay. All right. And I agree, but I think it has a lot to do, again, with education, with educating yourself. A lot of our elected officials not necessarily educated to all those things and ideas. You know, they come in, they bring together a group of people and they get them to vote for them and empower them to say that I'm doing the right thing through the Democrat Party, this party, that party. But they are not knowledgeable to what's out there. I think what's one of the first steps we have to do is make you become knowledgeable to what is available. And I think that's the problem, particularly if you're going to take that route.
And Dr. Rogers, here's my thing. I've actually been through this in Tucson and in Dallas. Our people have this thing that if you don't have a diploma, you have no knowledge.
Yeah,
I've gone to bat several times in the city of Dallas, and one of the people that I have much respect for is a brother by the name of John Wally Price that has fought good battle in Dallas for decades.
Good brother.
And the reason I like him, he surrounds himself with people that know what he doesn't know.
That's right.
Not all of our public figures are willing to do that. When I first met that man, I was actually doing some subcontracting work for the Dallas Housing Authority.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some stuff that was going on, and I didn't want to lose my contract. So I anonymously sent some information to him.
Mm-hmm.
About 8 or 9 months later, when he kept talking about it, because he was doing a radio show every Saturday morning, he kept talking about it, and I called in and told him that I had done it. I finally ended up meeting him face to face, and he asked, well, why did I do it anonymously? I said, because I don't hold a degree. I'm not a certified anything, but I'm knowledgeable about how that system should be run. And so I didn't want to put myself out there in the public and have to go through a bunch of changes with people. Our people, when they get into elected positions, and I'm sorry to say it as a blanket statement, but it's usually what I found out. Even here, when I brought my child back here in the school system, when I asked a question of somebody, and I knew the answer because I already had read through No Child Left Behind, but I'm kind of like a lawyer. If you're in a position of power, I ask you a question, I'm doing two things. I'm finding out if you're willing to be truthful or if you're going to play me for a fool. So I ask the question, and when I get back a response that's not a certified or bona fide answer, that's when I pull up my computer and say, look, I don't know who you're playing games with, but this is what the law says. I respect the person who tells me I don't know, and they go back and get the answer. What I don't like is too many people in power will feed you a line of BS and then will not admit what they do not know.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay, Brother Griffin, thank you. We've got a caller. I'm not sure if he wants to or her wants to talk. But I see that you're online here from Warren, Michigan. Good afternoon, caller.
Greetings, Dr. Rogers. My name is Leona, and I'm a first-time caller.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you calling. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I learned about your program through Dr. Bruce Bridges a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yes, yes. Dr. Bridges, very good friend. He's a very active member of our group.
Yes, sir. Well, I wanted to talk about ask a few questions about Marcus Garvey, if that's okay.
That's fine, sure.
To your knowledge, is it true that Marcus Garvey originally came to the USA because he wanted to meet Booker T. Washington?
Okay.
I asked you that because I came across some information. A couple of letters between Marcus Mosiah Garvey and Booker T. Washington back in September of 1914. And it seemed that based on my understanding of what I read, Marcus Messiah Garvey was an admirer of Booker T. Washington.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now, sometimes when people hear the words, I'll speak for myself. Back in the day when I used to hear the word Booker T. Washington, you know, the idea of quote-unquote Uncle Tom used to immediately follow that name. But since that time, I've had to reassess some of what Mr. Washington has said, and I'm still learning about him. Mm-hmm. But anyway, are you aware or do you agree that one of the reasons that Marcus Garvey came to the USA was to meet Booker T. Washington? That's one of my questions. Right. I have a couple more, if you don't mind.
Sure, yes.
You want me to go ahead with the question?
No, you can. Wait. Right. We can stop and answer this one, and you can go back to the others. It's however you'd like to do it. I'm okay. Well, first, let me add, you are absolutely right, and your research methodology is perfect, because to really understand some of what was going on during that time between those individuals, including Du Bois, those letters are the best source of getting that information, because a lot of the writings and the books that were published were obviously sometimes up to interpretation. The authors are trying to guide you to think a certain way. But when you go in and look at those letters, you see sometimes a different picture. And you're right.
Yeah.
Garvey was from Jamaica. He has a history outside of Jamaica before he came to the Americas. And his parents were very active business people, and so they understood the work of Booker T. Washington had done, and he was impressed. He read Up from Slavery. He read some of the other books that Booker T. Washington wrote that we don't hear a lot about. And so you are correct. That was his motivating factor, along with some other things that he wanted to put into action here in the Americas, you know, because at that time, you know, a lot of Africans in the diaspora had began to immigrate to here. The Pan-African movement was here, was moving toward the Americas. George Padmore, C.L.R. James, and all of them had began to come into the Americas. They were writing, they were publishing, you know, they were talking about these ideas and concepts. The Harlem Renaissance writers were heavy, even though Garvey comes in right at the kind of the beginning of the Harlem Renaissance. Claude McKay and all of these folks were publishing stuff and talking about conditions and life. So, yeah, that was exactly right. That opened the door for him to come in. And he also wanted to meet W.B. Du Bois. And that's another whole story, what happened when he met Du Bois. But he did actually go to meet Du Bois. And he ran into some serious conflict. He went to the NAACP office in Harlem, and he said when he walked in, the first thing he saw was all of the mulattoes. The office was filled with mulattoes. There were no people of dark color, and he wondered what did that mean, and what was that all about. And that's an interesting narrative. And Garvey wrote about this himself, you know. So there were some serious issues there that we're going to, that you would be worthy of explaining. On next Tuesday, we're going to bring a group on that has been studying Garvey for over 30 years. They're going to come on and talk about some of their studies and findings, you know, about that as well on next Tuesday. So does that kind of answer your question a little bit?
Yes, sir. I'll go on to the second one, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Now, I remember reading somewhere that Hubert Henry Harrison was instrumental in introducing Marcus Garvey to one of his first public appearances.
Who was that? What was that name you said?
Hubert Henry Harrison.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir. Hubert Henry Harrison out of Harlem.
Dr.
John Jackson used to call him the Black Socrates.
That's
Hubert
right.
Henry Harrison died at age 42. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
Yes,
man.
He was. He was a columnist, newspaper
columnist.
You
know anything? I'm sorry.
I said he was a newspaper columnist as well.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, and he was one of the few that talked about how in the Socialist Party it seemed like race was first and economics later. But that's I digress. Okay, let me go back to the other one question here.
Okay.
In terms of Marcus Garvey's original, some of his early followers, would you say that they were primarily made up of West Indian black folk? I heard a talk some years ago, well, not that long ago, Professor, I think his name was Robert Hill, I could be wrong. He seemed to suggest that some of Garvey's earlier followers were mostly West Indian people from the West Indians, mm-hmm. West Indies, rather.
Right.
You know anything about that?
Yeah. You know, I started our program off today with the ancestral profile that I do. And I talked about a brother whose name is Leonard Howell, H-O-W-E-L-L. And Leonard Howell uh-huh. is called the first Rastafari. And the significance of that is that a lot of that was linked to this new movement that was being galvanized and organized coming out of Jamaica, honoring Haile Selassie I, as the lost the arising Messiah, the new Messiah that has come back. And the whole idea mm-hmm. of putting Haile Selassie in that status was being led by a very large community of Jamaicans and West Indies. And as I said, they called themselves the Rastafari movement. And this brother, Howell, was at the vanguard of that. And he was active with Marcus Garvey. So you're right that this group, and I would suggest that you take a look. His name is Leonard Howell, H-O-W-E-L-L. And he wrote a book called The Promised Key. The Promised Key. And he's putting forward this whole Pan-African Rastafari legacy that is what we're going to begin to hear in Garvey's work. Now, whether or not Garvey is setting up his platform based on Howell's total philosophy, that I'm not sure of. What I am sure of is that they were all contemporaries. They all were working together. And very clearly their influences may have had a lot to do with it, including Hubert Harrison. And Hubert Harrison, as you know, was a very strong political activist. He was kind of more, I would put him where my brother Griffin, who just spoke earlier, was about making this thing work right here in this country. We can make it work. And Harrison's philosophy was geared toward that, you know. And the other Pan-Africans, you know, George G.M. James, very clearly, and George Padmore, were all in there. So a lot of Garvey's movement was being originally stimulated coming from Jamaica and some of those philosophies out of the Rastafari movement. That's why, you know, Bob Marley, Burning Spear, and all of those reggae groups now all promote Marcus Garvey. You know, I just played the opening song today was called Burning Spear was called Why We Following Marcus Garvey. I agree. I think it is. And so when you go to Jamaica, that's all you hear, Marcus Garvey. I had a chance to go to the 100th centennial of Garvey back in 1988. That was the whole city was Marcus Garvey. So you're right about that. I think, yes, that answers your question.
Okay. Well, the last one is, and I did hear part of the earlier opening of your show, and I was glad to hear you mention that Amy Garvey had a hand in helping salvage these philosophies and save his work and everything. But
right.
I also wanted to mention that he had two wives named Amy. Now,
exactly. Right. One,
and
yeah.
I share a quote from Amy Jocks Garvey that I found in one of her works, and I'll be brief. She says, quote, "The inherited slave complex of telling the master what was happening on the plantation dies hard with some of us, end quote. Some reason I...
That's powerful.
Yeah. Yes, sir. I thought so, too. That's why I saved that.
Oh, that's real
now
powerful.
I'm sorry?
I said, no, I'm just saying that. That's real powerful. That's very powerful. Uh-huh.
Yes, sir. My last question is, a few years ago, not that long ago, maybe in the last 3 years or so, I was listening to another radio program, and the late Dick Gregory was talking on that show, and the Honorable Dick Gregory, I will call him. He happened to mention, that Queen Mother Audley Moore had a hand in betraying Marcus Garvey.
Now
the details of that I don't remember, but I'm wondering, do you know anything about that, or have you heard anything? I heard Dick Gregory say this on a radio show. He said he knew some people didn't want to hear it, but he showed it, laid it out there, that Queen Mother Moore was instrumental in betraying Marcus Garvey. Have you heard anything like that? You know
no,
anything about
I have
anything
not,
like that?
I have not heard that. She would have been obviously a very young woman at the time. I know that there has been some debate over whether or not Garvey was misogynist in terms of the UNIA movement, which I totally disagree with that he was not. But anyway, there has been some debate. The group that will come on next Tuesday has done a lot of work on talking about the women who were part of the UNIA movement. So, you know, now I know the group that did fight to kill him were adverse. They were, you know, obviously Du Bois was a part of that. But I think it was based on some other stuff. It wasn't just based on his ideology of back to Africa, because that wasn't what Garvey's philosophy was totally about. That was a part of it, but it wasn't what it was all about. I think it was something else doing with some other more intricate issues, which would be excellent to talk about at some another point. But no, I did not hear that.
So hear anything about...
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was wondering, so you're not aware of anything about a Queen Mother Moore and Marcus Garvey connection?
Not in the negative way. Like I said, she would have been a very young woman at that time, you know, considering when Garvey was around and when he was working. She would have had to have been, I don't know exactly when Queen Mother Moore was born, but she would have had to have been a young woman. My knowledge of Queen Mother Moore and the work that she did was her early years of getting involved with the reparations movement. That was, and she was a part of that very early, you know, more than when more people
yes,
did.
Sir.
So, that would be interesting in looking at. I'm glad you mentioned it. I may take a look at some of that there, and maybe I can ask this group that's going to come on Tuesday, because, like I said, they have studied the women who were part of the UNIA movement, and let's find out if Queen Mother Moore had that. And you said you heard this was Dick Gregory said this?
Yes, sir. It was on a radio show.
Okay.
I could tell you the name of the radio show. I don't know if that's appropriate or not, but it was on the Carl Nelson radio show.
That's
that
interesting.
I heard Dick Gregory say this.
I guess it's worthy of some investigation. Yeah. I guess it might say some critical things about the movement itself and, you know, what was going on at that time. I was very interested. That's that time period is so critical. There were so many contemporaries there that were powerful men and women that were working together and working in sometimes in conflict with each other, you know, Du Bois, Garvey, Booker T, Mary Church Terrell. Just a cadre of people that was there. And somehow or the other, I've often asked the question, with all that mind power, you know, that was serious brain power there. What was stopping them from being able to get together and really work on some things and make things happen? You know, Harold Cruz wrote that book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. Brother from Philadelphia was just talking about it a few minutes ago. Cruz gets into some of that, too. I may even, and I read that book years ago. I can't remember all of it. I wonder if Cruz might have mentioned something about that. But he was talking about what the conflict was among those that brain trust that was out there in Black America and what was causing the problem. And one of them was, he said, that the West Indian thing. There was some resistance from the American blacks, American Africans, versus the West Indian African. There was some conflict. Yeah, definitely. And Cruz touches on it, and some others have touched on that conflict. I've got a brother on now from Arizona. He's a brother Marcus. He's from the West Indies. I don't know if he knows anything about it. He's very conscious, but you know, he's a constant caller. But that's a great thought.
I thank you for taking the time to answer my question.
Oh, no doubt about it. Please call again. Thank you so much for calling in. Dr. Bridges told me that you would, and he now very well he may know, because he's definitely in his book. Recapturing the African Mind, he really went into that Pan-African.
Yeah, I'm reading that now, in fact. Okay. Yes, I've started reading that.
Have you
now
gotten to that part of the Pan-African piece yet?
No, sir, not yet.
Okay, all right. He might touch on that. If not, we'll bring him on here one day and see if we can find out what's going on. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Okay, have a great day.
Yes, sir. Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I do have a caller from Durham, North Carolina. I don't know if they want to say anything. 768.
Yes. Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Brother White, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Yes.
What I'd like to say about what you spoke about, what do we have to do?
Okay. Good.
And it's interesting that you just mentioned Dr. Bridges' book, Recapturing the African Mind.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that we have among black people, that why we're so unsuccessful at some of the things that we're trying to do, is because we don't trust one another.
Okay, I agree.
We've been trained not to trust one another. And so when you have one organization, another organization, these people, the nature of the organizations is that they don't trust one another,
mm-hmm,
because they've lost track of the fact that we are all Africans.
Mm-hmm.
But we've forgotten or has been obliterated what it means to be an African.
Okay.
So we need to start with ourselves. We need to start with training each individual of what it means to be an African.
Hmm.
If you just take, for instance, the building of the pyramids, they say it was like over 20,000 people that was building the pyramids. They didn't have no unions. They didn't have no fights. They didn't have no labor disputes. What was it about these people that were able to make them work on something so enormous and so complicated for 20 years or more? And the thing that they were building, they wasn't going to make no money off of it.
That's powerful.
But they all worked together to do it because they were all Africans. This is who we were before we encountered the beast. All the things that we're talking about now is we are reacting to the problems and the things that are happening to us here in a European-run society, and trying to solve the problems using European methods because we've forgotten how to be African.
There we go.
If you learn again how to be an African and to understand what this means, then you'll know what to do and what to think in every situation. Because you won't have European ideals, European greed and status and that kind of stuff that didn't exist with us. Who got the most of this or who's got the most of that? And if I made a vow, a personal vow, with the studying that I've done about African spirituality.
Okay.
And if every black person in America made this vow, just think of what it would mean. The vow that I made was that I would never do anything again in my life to harm another African person.
There we go.
If everybody made that decision and lived to it, what would that do overnight? If you didn't have to fear anything from another black person, African person.
There we go. You have just laid out the primary detailed principle of Marcus Garvey's work. That's exactly what he wanted to do. You have got to raise up the African in you. You got to do that. And you got to do it from African principles and teachings. Oh, Brother White, you hit it. You hit it dead on end. You knocked that ball straight out of the park. That's exactly right. And I think that's what we've been trying to say. Now, let me ask you this, Brother White, so I can be clear. Considering America now and the way we are, popular culture, Facebook, Twitter, all them other instruments, rap music, hip-hop music, motion pictures, how do we galvanize particularly young people together in order to do that? What process do you see? I know you can't give me a flat blank answer, but what is the process to getting into some of that? Because you can't tell them to cut the music off because they're not going to cut it off. They're not going to turn off their phones. So what do we do? How do you do that from your perspective?
This is a very monumental task considering all the things that are working against African principles.
Right.
African principles have no value in this society.
Right. That's true.
None whatsoever.
That's right.
That's why we're not taught anything about Africans, about being African, about trusting each other, about caring about each other, and about recognizing that we all family, that light skin, dark skin, all of that stuff is. So how we would do this, I would say it would take a genius of a few people that can understand how to start something and to inspire people. Because what Marcus Garvey did was unbelievable. Without radio and television and all that, how he got his message and how his message resonated with people. It's the Africanness is still in our DNA. It's just buried so deep and whatnot. We don't know how to reach it and how to awaken it. But when African people are left alone, we start to revert back to our Africanness.
Right.
That the examples of the black communities of, Black Wall Street, Durham, and other all black towns, when black people were left alone, they started to revert back to their African principles. It's in our DNA. The problem is there's so much misinformation, so much lies, and when you do start any kind of movement, it's immediately attacked.
Right.
So how are we going to do this? They say a problem well stated is a problem half solved. If we know what we should be doing and what we need to do, how much can each individual do?
That's exactly right.
To enlighten another individual or another few individuals. I was struck by the show last week when the sister from Greensboro said that, she has started several initiatives and they worked for a while and they petered out.
Right.
And that's when I thought right then, the reason they didn't survive was because people didn't trust each other. You remember, after the Million Man March, the first thing everybody wanted to know, what happened to that money? How much money? Where did that money go?
They sure did. They were,
that's a European concept, mm-hmm. Counting and measuring. Where's the money? I don't trust. Why, get distracted by things like that.
Mm-hmm.
When that's not part of the African principle,
right,
of money and greed. Malefi Asante, like I said, he said that if you buy something for $10 and sell it for $100, to a European, you're a good businessman. To an African, you're a thief.
That's right.
So we've lost that kind of thinking. It's all about getting over, getting paid. I got to get mine.
Right.
And not about I got to share mine.
That's exactly.
I went to a meeting in when I was still in New York at Bethany Baptist Church on Sumner Avenue. Dr. Augustus Jones was the pastor. And at the end of the meeting, Brother Kevin Muhammad, who's the mosque in Brooklyn, he closed the meeting out. And one of the things he said was, true brotherhood is wishing for your brother what you wish for yourself, even though you know you're not going to get it.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
What do we wish for our neighbors right now?
Mm-hmm. Right. Good question. Let me go over here to Brother Marcus. Brother Marcus, how you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing good, good brother, Dr. Rogers. Doing excellent.
Yes, sir.
I see you talking about my favorite man, Marcus Garvey. His name is more reverend to me than Jesus Christ, I tell you. Okay?
A lot
of Negroes don't want to hear that. But if they would embrace that, we'd be much farther ahead.
Okay.
Now, in reference to what the sisters call and talk about, ask if most of Garvey's supporters were West Indian. To the contrary, no. His support came from the black people right here in America.
Okay.
You see, because the thing is, the black people in America, they know they're black. You don't have to convince black people in America that.
Okay. Brother Marcus, you still there? Brother Marcus? I think I heard his phone going out. Brother Marcus, if you're there, you can...
Can you hear me now?
Okay, I got you. Got you now. Okay, great.
Yes, so what I'm saying is that most of Garvey's support came from black people here in America, because the European treated the black people in America so bad that it created a group of black people that were racially conscious of the blackness. You see, when they deported Garvey and sent Garvey to Jamaica, Garvey caught hell in Jamaica when he went back from
yes,
the black
yeah,
people because they couldn't embrace what he was saying. They couldn't, the concept of race black people in the Caribbean they couldn't grasp it. Because, you see, what happened in the Caribbean and in Africa, the whites don't rule direct.
Right.
They rule through proxy.
Right.
They rule through their black flunkies. So, the black people in the Caribbean don't see it, the white man as the enemy. They see their own black people because he's behind the scenes. It's the same thing they do in Africa. They use proxy. They use their black flunkies to do their job. You see? But what we have to do is just pick up from where Garvey left off. You see, when Garvey started to acquire those ships, that's when they made the move on Garvey. Because they said, wow, now he's going to start to develop trade. Now he's got to start move people back and forth. That's where we need to pick up. Just pick up from where he left off. Get a Pan-African shipping line. Because you're going to need a shipping line to move goods and services and people.
I like that.
See? We're going to be so let's a lot of the work. We don't need to reinvent the wheel.
No, we don't.
You know, we just need, just pick up from where the man left off and carry on.
Right.
And we know that Africa has a lot of problems. We know that. But again, the solution is not here, because 400 years we have been here trying to work something honorably out with this white man. And we can't, in 400 years, we have, In fact, we are in a worse condition now than our people were in the 20s, because at least in the 20s they had a Black Wall Street, they had, you know, and those things were destroyed, never to be replicated again. Nowhere in America. Nowhere in America you can go and find a Black Wall Street again.
Right.
So they demonstrated to you that you're not going to build a Black empire here in America. See? Where we were great is where we were great in the past. Africa. I don't know why it's so difficult for us. You know, I don't think a person can say they love Black people and hate Africa. That is a contradiction. You can't say you love Black people, but at the same time against Africa. You know, that's what they call it, that double consciousness that Du Bois is talking about.
Yes.
You know, that split personality, you know, and that's what America does to Black people.
Yes, it does.
That split personality, you know, see if you, are you worth anything? Are you going to try to measure up to this monster?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I appreciate the program. I appreciate, you know, we're hitting the point on Garvey.
Thank you.
And there was a man that we should study also that came after Garvey, called Carlos Cooks.
Mm.
You see? But Cooks took out the religion and he took out the politics out of the Garvey movement.
Mm-hmm.
He said we should embrace race and economics.
Mm.
Leave your politics and your religion at the door. Because we don't get shot because, you know, we are Protestant or Muslim. You get shot because you're Black.
You're Black.
So that is what we need to do. It's simple. But you see, sometimes we intellectualize this thing too much, you know. It's time to get to work. It's work time now. Because we see this thing is falling. This thing is collapsing. And we got to study history with these crackers. When this thing starts to hit the fan, they go get their guns. That's the way they believe.
That's the way they respond. That's
he
exactly
who
right.
kill the most has the most. That's the way they believe. They ain't going to always pray. They go get their pistol and start killing people wholesale.
That's right. So that's exactly right.
We get on the good foot, quick, fast, and in a hurry. Anyway, but that's all right. Just take care.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Brother Marcus. Thank you for calling.
All right, brother.
And very clearly, you know, we said that the name of the program today was Up, You Mighty Race, You Can Achieve What You Will. And that's Garvey's words. And I think that it's important that we understand what those words are actually saying. It says to me that if you're going to lead our people, or if you're going to become a part of a movement for change, you first of all, you've got to believe that they can change, that you've got to believe that they have the power inside of them to do this. So when he says, you can accomplish what you will, he's saying, I know. Even with all of the stuff that's going on around you, I know that you can rise up and make some difference. I know that. And so he that's a very important statement. You can accomplish what you will. So, and there's a lot of logic to the idea that, you know, people can change, you know, that you can empower yourself, that you can wake up, you know, and if a lot of you who are scientific and you believe in the empirical process of things and, you know, you prefer that more than a spiritual, then fine. Medicine, modern science has said that within the psychology and the body, the human body, is that you can wake yourself up. You can heal yourself. The body can heal itself. You know, they're even talking about that when it comes to things like cancer, that you can heal yourself. And so, therefore, I'm very clearly very appreciative of those words, and I think we should take a look at that. There's a wonderful book that Garvey wrote, Marcus Garvey's philosophy. It's called God and Nature First Made Us, What We Are. You know, and he talks about all of that. He talks about what is the African? What is that? What does that mean? When we say we are a mighty race, he says, oh, you mighty race. Where is that coming from? It's not just because the pyramids were there. It goes beyond the pyramids and all that stuff. You know, there's other things that we have to look at. When we look at the Ashanti Empire and we look at Queen Nzinga in Angola You know, you're dealing with mighty might, you know, and so we got to have a belief in doing that. You know, you've been listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. You know, we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10, right here on timeforanawakening.com. There's other programs here, African Perspectives with Brother Osiemi Adelabu comes on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 to 1, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 to 1, right here on Time for Awakening. Then we have Time for an Awakening program that is done by Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, who comes on Friday from 8 to 10 and Sunday from 7 to 10. Dynamic program, very engaging conversations. Things like this, what we're talking about. Brother Richard has a wonderful array of guests that he brings forward and talks with. And so we suggest highly that you listen. You can just simply listen by going to 215, if you like, 490-9832. That's the call-in number. Or either go to www.timeforanawakening.com. I'm also on Black Reality Think Tank is on Blog Talk Radio on Saturdays from 4 to 6 p.m., 4 to 6 p.m. on Saturday. You go to our Black Reality Think Tank webpage on Facebook, and there's always a link directing you to how to log in to the program on Saturday. And then on Sunday, we have another program sponsored by the Sankofa Historical Society called Gospel Gold that looks at the history and the impact and the power of gospel music. And that's done by Reverend Michael Rogers out of North Carolina, Holly Springs Baptist Church, pastor of Holly Springs Baptist Church. He does a wonderful job of doing that. He took a look this past week at some of the music that regenerated in the civil rights movement and that was responsible for energizing the civil rights. He looks at the history of that and talks about it from a historical perspective. And so we encourage you. That's every Sunday evening from 11 p.m. Eastern Time to 12. I've got another caller on from Greensboro, North Carolina, 336. Good afternoon, caller. How you doing?
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hey, Brother Rogers, Dr. Rogers. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Good program, important information. Not information, but important messages.
Thank
important
you.
Dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I love what Brother Marcus, I think it was Marcus, that just said, you know, it's not that hard, mm-hmm. and that we, you know, make things that are easy actually difficult. And when we intellectualize and, you know, keep asking what the solution is and I always say, you know, the solutions that are right here in front of our faces, we've had people like Garvey and others give us a solution. We just got to follow the blueprint,
right?
You know. But I wanted to share something. I had a conversation yesterday with a young adult. And she's someone who we wouldn't say is in the conscious community, but she knows what's going on. And the conversation just really left a mark on me. So I asked her if her generation, when they see what's going on in general, you know, in population with our people getting killed, the young lady's still getting slit, just all the various attacks and the things that are no longer you know, hidden, they're just out front. I said, how do you guys feel about this? What do you all have going on? Again, they're not, you know, revolutionaries or anything. They're just kind of your church going, you know, just trying to do the right thing, people. And her answer was that they feel hopeless.
Mm.
They feel hopeless. They don't know what to do. And they are just really afraid. Now, I asked this particular person because she has her finger on the pulse of her peers, you know, and the whole Christian community, not the whole, but the Christian community, because she does a lot of motivational speaking. You know, she gets around. She knows she comes into contact with hundreds of people. And then, of course, the whole social media thing. And she said that that's the general feeling. And I was actually devastated when she said that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started talking, and I could hear that they really want some answers. So the answers that we know of, they don't have them. Okay. So the one thing I learned, you know, just in real time, is that they're not getting, we're not passing down the consciousness that needs to be passed down to them. And we haven't done it adequately for the past, you know, 20, 30 years. And that is our responsibility, that we have to do better with that, as elders, as people that are conscious, et cetera, et cetera. Other thing, I was talking to someone, and they were saying, oh, I don't really want to listen to the show, because, you know, I market the show, and I tell people, oh, I don't want to hear the same thing over and over again, you know. And getting back to our young people, we forget that they have to be taught by somebody. They have to have some media to listen to. And the other thing she said, I said, this young person that I was talking with, I said, well, where do you all get your information from? She said, well, we pretty much get it from CNN, you know, Fox News. That's where they're getting their information from. So their level of consciousness depends on whatever CNN tells them. I said, well, who do you all see as, you know, leaders, or, you know, so who are people that are speaking up for black people's interests? She said, Angela Rye and Maxine Waters. Two black women, no males. And so having that conversation really had me thinking, and again, I'm thinking about our responsibility, you know, to pass this down. The thing that Brother Marcus said was just very powerful, and I kind of missed some of it because I had to go outside. It was thundering and whatnot over here. But we've fallen so deep into Eurocentric culture that we have really lost the importance of the youth. The youth comes first in our culture, you know, and we abandon them. We abandon them for the money and the, you know, prominence, right, and exactly. Fighting to get in somebody's golf club that does not want you.
Right.
Fighting to get into places where we're not wanted. You know, young people don't respect that. They may be glad that they can get in somewhere, which is, you know, unfortunate that you want to be with somebody that doesn't want you. But people don't respect that, you know, when you really look at it. So I wanted to make those comments because we really, you know, in terms of things to do, like the brother said, just pick up where Garvey, you know, left off, or the movement left off. And it is picking up, you know. So find out how you can start a chapter in your city. That's one thing that we can do.
You told me, I think you told me that was a UNIA chapter, which is the United Negro Improvement Association, which is started by Garvey, in Greensboro. Did you tell me that's where it was?
And I was actually looking at starting one, because I think he's a vice president in Philly. I don't know if it's the state or national, whatever. I can't remember. But he was going to send me his plan is to send me the materials to start one in Greensboro.
Excellent.
You know,
okay.
So, but that can, anybody can do that. By the way, anybody can do that. Start a UNIA chapter in your city. Just contact the necessary people, get the necessary information, and understand that it's race first.
Okay.
It's not a multicultural, you know, Black Lives Matter thing. It's race first.
Actually, there's a book. There's a book by Tony Gilmore called Race First. Uh-huh. Right.
Really?
But I hear you. He's writing about Garvey, and he wrote a book called Race First. But go ahead. I'm sorry. Uh-huh.
And, you know, the other thing is the sad piece is that I think we're going to have to be forced into coming back together and working with each other, learning to trust each other all over again. I think we're going to have to be forced because I said it on one of the other shows, white supremacy has been marketed so, and whiteness has been marketed so powerfully, it's hard to snatch some of our people out of that. So they're going to have to be forced out.
Yeah, okay, all right.
You know, that's the truth. But those of us that get it, you know, understand the beauty and the power of being African and practicing Vodun, learning about Vodun and Ifa and the Dangata, you know, African spiritual systems, we can... In the meanwhile, build. We continue to build. And, you know, when people get tired of, being slaughtered. You know, they'll have something to come to. But we do have to build more. We have to, so I want to say that we have to teach more, and we have to build more. One more thing. At 10 o'clock, there's a program coming on that I just found out about the white militia movement. And it's related to that Charleston, white supremacist march that happened last year?
Virginia.
Yeah. So they're having another march during the weekend coming. But this documentary is coming on. And as I was listening, you know, to the information, these people are busy. And so Garvey said we would sleep. Absolutely. They're busy.
Right.
While we're busy, you know, doing whatever we do, they're preparing militarily.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
They are preparing. And our young people are the middle of the road, black folk. They don't know that. They need to know that.
Okay.
And one more quick thing. My question to everybody is, if there was no God, and if Jesus was not coming back, what would we do?
Okay. Good question.
What would we do then?
All
right. So I'm going to end there.
Okay. The program that you're talking about, Brother Griffin just texted me and said it's Frontline. Frontline is coming on. It's on.
Frontline, yes, right. Yes. But there, a lot of those white militias, they ex-military,
right.
You know, they are preparing.
Okay. All right, Brother Griffin, you had a remark, a question, point?
I just wanted to compliment her for really bringing to the forefront about our young people falling for CNN and MSM news. I spend a lot of time trying to talk to young people I meet that I get upset with the Angela Rise and the other young lady, Simone, that are so well-spoken. But the only one I really see that brings things home, and she's in a platform where she really can't do a black spin on it, but she's very professional and stays to the point, is a young lady, Yamiche Alcindor, that's on PBS. I'd love to see her get a show of her own and speak from a black perspective, because Angela Rydham are very intelligent women, but they spend so much time doing the I'm going to be black thing. When the truth is, you are on a platform that you should be speaking the facts so that the young people will stop having an entertainment attitude and be more interested
right.
in gaining
right.
knowledge.
There we go. That's right. How do we do that? How do we do that? And obviously, you've indicated that. And, you know, I proposed an idea that I've been saying on the Black Reality Think Tank ever since we began, Saturday schools. I call it that. That's a private system of educating children in our community on a private basis behind closed doors. That's how I say it. Brothers, sisters,
am I still on, Doc?
Yeah, go ahead. Uh-huh.
Okay. Again, that complicating simple things, that's a very real issue. I'm really beginning to see that. We can go to our pastors, mosques, community centers, and say we need to do something for our communities, and we need a venue. We need your venue. And ask them to donate, because we got to stop focusing on money all the time. Everything doesn't have to cost money. We need your venue and invite the community. That's one thing I've done successfully. You know, I'd like to revive it, but invite the community out to watch Hidden Colors 3. That has awakened a lot of people.
Right.
You know, there are all kinds of documentaries that can open people's eyes and wake them up and motivate them into action.
Right.
So we have tools, you know, but we got to stop. We really have to stop focusing on, well, it's going to cost this and it's going to cost that. We're in a struggle for our lives. Everybody's got to participate.
That's right.
And there are passes. When you break it down, you take them and have a personal showing of one of these documentaries to them. And I have found my experience. They say, oh, yeah, I'll open my space up. I'll open my space up to bring in, you know, Professor Smalls or Umar Jones, whomever. You know, these are tools that we can use to begin that process that you're talking about, or to continue it.
Right. Right. That's exactly right. So I think you're right. I think very clearly, Brother Griffin, we got to talk to our young people. We really do. And we've got to do it in a way that they can stand on a platform and present that. I mean, because that's what was done for us. You know, I remember and very clearly I was a very active person in a black church. And we were given carte blanche by the church that I used to attend in Durham, North Carolina, to do kind of all kind of stuff, all kind of programs and stuff like that. And, you know, they would sit back and watch us, but, you know, they let us do, and that was civil rights time. They didn't stop us. Like a lot of the church folk didn't like it, the fact that we were out there marching and doing some of that stuff, but they didn't stop us. And I used that because that was the movement of the time. And even when we embraced more radical things like Malcolm's ideas and the nation, you know, they watched us do it, you know, they didn't stop us per se. And, you know, our inner self wanted to seek more information. That's the way I was. I wanted to know more stuff. I mean, this was deep. I had never heard things like this. And so I will admit we didn't have some of the things that distract us that the young people have today, but very clearly it was said. So I think we are there, and we've got to move forward to that. We got to talk more about it. Sister Ayan is coaching one of our younger producers on the Black Reality Think Tank. She does a program on relationships to her. Her name is Shannon B. She's in her 30s, and she says that her interest is family and relationships. She said, getting her man to do right so she can raise her baby. She said she needs her man there with her, and she needs him there with her, helping her raise her baby. So she's trying to find a way to talk to the brothers and ask them, why y'all doing this? We need you. You know, and so Sister Yan has been coaching her and talking to her on how to do that. She's had a couple of wonderful programs on Saturday, on the Black Reality Think Tank on Saturday, talking about love and relationships and how to get brothers together. And guess what? The brothers are calling in talking. In some cases, not a lot, I mean, but we don't need a lot. And they're calling in, stressing their interests and their points and saying some very powerful things. And the sisters are calling too, and it's not a battering thing. They're not calling in, talking about each other and, you know, saying all kind of ugly names. That's not what they're doing. So I would encourage us to do more of that, and I think that first find out what's their concern. What do they see as a problem? You know, maybe they don't see Dylann Roof. And I use him because he's the poster boy for white terrorism. That's what I call it. They don't see Dylann Roof. So, okay. All right, but you let them know that Dylann Roof's there, but then what is it that you then see, you know, in lack of that? And so some of the questions that you all have posed. I'm going to let Brother Timothy close us out. I know we had started off with him. I appreciate him. Brother Timothy, any closing thoughts you got?
Yes, sir. I had a friend of mine that had a coin some time ago, and it just came in my mind what it said. I think he said, out of many nations, one people, or out of many people, one nation.
Yeah.
And I think that statement came from Marcus Garvey.
Right. Possibly. I can't confirm.
I think we're on the right track, and I can't wait to tune in next Tuesday because you look at things about Marcus Garvey's movement and the professionalism that he had with him. I mean, he had some great, like you had Timothy Thomas, Fortune. He had the number one scholars in Harlem.
Yeah.
He had a machine that when you unravel it, you would say, yeah, he was amazing. For that time period, he would be amazing. Matter of fact, he'd be more amazing today.
right.
He would be more amazing with a black movement, with all of us together today, worldwide. Just look at that.
Right.
And this program that I listened to tonight, it seemed like everybody brought a piece of the puzzle to put it together as a whole. I'm serious. Everybody had something to contribute. Nobody was off course. Everybody was right on page. Right. You know, right on page, right on point.
That's exactly
so
right.
That's the wonder and the beauty of this program, Dr. Rogers, you have together here. It's very unique. Everybody don't talk like this.
I know.
I can't speak for anybody else.
But as Garvey said, we can achieve.
I have to do some more research.
Right. We can achieve.
Put all the rest of the pieces of the puzzle together so we can just continue to fly.
That's right.
It's been flying so high, nobody can click our wings, man.
That's right. That's right, my brother. So, ladies and gentlemen, next week we will be here with the second part of the Garvey movement ideology. We are going to have a group from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, called Africans on the Move. They are part of the Pan-African Revolutionary Socialist Party, and they have dedicated their lives. Now, these are young people I want to tell you about. Now, these were students. These were students from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, who were part of Dr. Yambalia's class and his work and his research. These are students, and they have been in existence now for well over 20 years. They are going to continue to live the teaching and the following and the philosophy of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. And so they're going to be here next week, and we're going to talk a little bit about Dr. Yambalia's work and what he did. Hopefully, maybe we can ask his lovely queen, Sister Yambalia, to join us in just a few words and conversation. You know, he had recently transitioned, so she's still in that stage of missing her loved one. So we won't impose upon her duty, but if she can, I would greatly appreciate it. I know they are listening tonight, very clearly, we are looking forward next week to a real dynamic conversation. I thank all of you, my brothers and sisters, for joining us here tonight. We appreciate you. We appreciate the work that you're doing and you're continuing, and we ask that we all continue because we have got to help with our children. We have got to do that. Thank you, and have a wonderful week, my brothers and sisters. I'll see you next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time.
Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said another brother's dead. They said